Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for In the News and American Stories, coming up after As It Is.
From VOA Learning English, this is As It Is. I'm Ana Mateo in Washington. Coming up in the second half of our show, we will hear about how affordable mangoes are one person's dream, but another person's problem. But first, we hear about a dead zone in waters near the United States. This dead zone has nothing to do with burial places, zombies, or monsters. Christopher Cruz tells us what a dead zone is and how some scientists are trying to bring it back to life.
The area known as a dead zone develops every spring in the Gulf of Mexico near the mouth of the Mississippi River. It can be as large as 13,600 square kilometers, extending all the way to the eastern Texas shoreline. Scientists know what causes this dead zone, and a new study suggests an answer. But the solution might be hard to accept for those who live far away from the coastline. Bayani Cardenas is a professor of water studies at the University of Texas at Austin. He wondered why natural cleaning or filtration does not remove nitrates from the Mississippi River that create the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. He says rivers generally filter out materials like nitrates. Professor Cardenas says his recent study shows that more than 99% of the river's water does pass through the riverbank material, or sediments, on its way south. But he adds that the river system is simply overwhelmed by the amount of nitrogen it carries. This nitrogen-rich water supports the growth of algae. As the algae dies, it sinks to the bottom where it breaks down or decomposes, taking oxygen from the water. This condition is called hypoxia and is deadly to fish and shrimp. The Mississippi River system carries water to the Gulf from 33 states and two Canadian provinces. Along the way, chemicals like nitrogen that are used in farming enter the river system. Aaron Packman is a civil and environmental engineering professor at Northwestern University. He says farmers may be able to better control the amount of nitrate fertilizer they put on fields.
How much fertilizer do you need to give you good yields, and then how much is maybe the marginal gain from adding lots more fertilizer? So there's really a question, could you back that off and maybe get close to the same level of yield without having so much of a negative impact?
The water in the Mississippi River system should be able to clean or filter itself naturally as it flows downstream. But human-made structures used to improve travel on the river and to control floods have hurt this natural cleaning process. In the coming months, storms will mix the Gulf water and the dead zone will disappear. But it will return next year. And scientists say it will grow larger in years to come if something is not done to reduce the amount of nitrogen in the Mississippi River. I'm Christopher Cruz.
Thanks, Christopher. And I'm Anna Mateo in Washington. You are listening to As It Is. Just heard about high levels of nitrogen in the Mississippi River system, creating a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. But nitrogen is needed for farming, proving yet again that sometimes too much of a good thing is not good at all. In this next story, the same can be said about mangoes. India and the European Union are involved in a heated trade fight over mangoes. The EU has banned them, but most people in India are not complaining. The ban has led to a flood of mangoes in local Indian markets and a sharp drop in prices. Prices for one kind, the Alfonso mango, have crashed or fallen fast and far. This type of mango is usually so costly that it is out of reach for middle-class households. Pradima Div in New Delhi had stocked up on vegetables and fruits during the weekend. But after reading reports that prices of the prized Alfonso mango had crashed, she rushed back to the supermarket to buy more, or as she puts it, to get her fill.
I'm delighted. I'm absolutely delighted we can have our fill of it now. I just can't believe it.
Ms. Div can thank a tiny fruit fly. The European Union imposed an 18-month ban on Indian mangoes, along with a few other vegetables, after finding fruit flies in some of the produce. When the ban went into effect on May 1st, prices of the Alfonso mango fell to their lowest level in nearly 20 years. There are several kinds of mangoes, but the Alfonso mango is known as the king of the mango. It is popular from Japan to Europe. As it usually happens, its popularity raised the price and forced most Indians to look for more affordable varieties. While shoppers in India are enjoying the surplus of Alfonso mangoes, exporters are having a different experience. The ban is hitting them hard and is directly affecting their profits. Officials in New Delhi have asked the European Union to reconsider the ban. They have even threatened to take the issue to the World Trade Organization. This is not the first time that the mango has been involved in high-level diplomacy. Indian officials often give the prized fruit to foreign leaders. And in 2006, India and the U.S. struck what is now known as the Mango for Bikes deal. New Delhi reportedly permitted Harley-Davidson motorcycle imports in exchange for lifting an 18-year ban on mango imports by the United States. I'm Anna Mateo. Find us on Facebook, iTunes, or Twitter. Stay tuned for more Learning English programs.
In the News is next, followed by American Stories. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English. From VOA Learning English, this is In the News. President Barack Obama this week announced plans for bringing America's longest war to what he called a responsible end. He said that this year, the United States will finish its combat operations in Afghanistan and give Afghan forces control of the country's security. Mr. Obama said that after 2014, 9,800 U.S. troops will remain in Afghanistan. But, he said, they all could be withdrawn if Afghan leaders do not sign a joint security agreement. Under the president's plan, U.S. forces will be out of the country by the time he leaves office in 2017. The only soldiers left will guard the embassy and diplomats. That would be similar to the situation in Iraq, where Mr. Obama withdrew troops in 2011. On Wednesday, the president spoke to the men and women finishing study programs at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. He told them that, "You are the first class to graduate since 9/11 who may not be sent into combat in Iraq or Afghanistan." President Obama used the speech to answer critics of his foreign policy. He said, "The United States is the most indispensable nation in the world," but he warned against new military interventions. Critics have called Mr. Obama's foreign policy unclear and weak. They point to his decision not to follow up on threats to attack Syria when it used chemical weapons. They also have criticized his failure to stop Russia from interfering in Ukraine. In his speech, Mr. Obama said that the most direct threat to America at home and abroad remains terrorism.
"First, let me repeat a principle I put forward at the outset of my presidency. The United States will use military force unilaterally if necessary when our core interests demand it."
Mr. Obama called for a new $5 billion plan to help Yemen, Somalia, Libya, and Mali fight terrorists. He also said the U.S. would continue drone strikes against terrorists and support for Syrian opposition groups. One of Mr. Obama's critics is Arizona Senator John McCain. Mr. McCain says the United States should be arming Syrian rebels. He also is critical of Mr. Obama's plan for withdrawing troops from Afghanistan. The senator spoke on Phoenix radio station KFYI on the Barry Young Show.
"We're now seeing a replay of Iraq in Afghanistan, and one can only question whether this whole basis was that he would be able to say at the end of his term that the troops are out of both countries. But the first thing the United States of America needs to regain is its credibility."
It is in Congress where Mr. Obama faces much of the criticism over his foreign policy. Michael O'Hanlon is with the Brookings Institution. He says the president's decision to avoid military action in Syria and Ukraine is probably what most Americans wanted. Studies have shown that Americans are tired of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and do not support more military adventures.
You add up the whole picture, it starts to look a little weak. And then you're open to the charge that foreign leaders have figured out you don't want to do much, and they're exploiting that window of opportunity, which is, of course, the charge being made about why Putin got so aggressive on the Crimea.
And that's In the News from VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember.
Now, the special English program, American Stories. Our story today is called Charles. It was written by Shirley Jackson. Here is Kay Gallant with the story.
The day my son Laurie started going to school, he began wearing blue jeans with a belt. I watched him leave with the older girl who lived next door. I clearly saw that this was the end of a period in my life. My sweet-voiced baby had suddenly changed. He was now a little man who was too full of himself to say goodbye to his mother. My son came home the same way. He shut the front door hard, threw his hat on the floor, and shouted, "Isn't anybody here?" At lunch, he spoke roughly to his father. "How was school today?" I asked. "Oh, all right," he said. His father asked if he had learned anything. Laurie looked at his father coldly. He said he had learned nothing. "The teacher punished a boy, though," Laurie said, with his mouth full of bread and butter. "What did he do?" I asked. "Who was it?" Laurie thought for a minute. "It was Charles," he said. "Charles was bad. The teacher hit him and made him stand in a corner. He was very bad." "What did he do?" I asked again. But Laurie slid off his chair, took a cookie, and left, while his father was still saying, "See here, young man." The next day, Laurie said at lunch, "Well, Charles was bad again today. Today, Charles hit the teacher." "Good heavens," I said. "I suppose he got punished again." "He sure did," Laurie said. "Why did Charles hit the teacher?" I asked. "Because she tried to make him use red paints. Charles wanted to use green paints, so he hit her. Then she hit him on the bottom and said nobody should play with him. But everybody did." The third day, Wednesday, Charles hit a little girl on the head with a piece of wood. The teacher made him remain inside all during playtime. Thursday, Charles had to stay in a corner during story time because he kept beating his feet on the floor. Friday, Charles was punished again because he threw a piece of chalk from the blackboard. I said to my husband that perhaps school was not so good for Laurie after all. He could be a rough boy. And this Charles sounded like such a bad influence. "It will be all right," my husband said. "There are sure to be people like Charles in the world. Laurie might as well meet them now as later." The second week, Laurie came home full of news. "Charles!" he shouted as he came up the hill. I was waiting on the front steps. "Charles!" Laurie shouted all the way up the hill. "Charles was bad again!" "Come right in," I said as soon as he came close enough. "Lunch is waiting." "Hello, Pop, you old mop," he said to his father as he came through the door. "You know what Charles did? Charles shouted so loudly in school that they sent a boy from another class to tell the teacher to make Charles keep quiet. And so Charles had to stay after school. All the children stayed to watch him." "What did he do then?" I asked. "He just sat there," Laurie said, climbing into his chair at the table. "What does Charles look like?" my husband asked Laurie. "What is his other name?" "He's bigger than me," Laurie said, "and he does not have any rubber shoes to wear when it rains, and he does not wear a jacket." Monday night was the first parent-teachers meeting. I wanted to go. I wanted very much to meet Charles' mother. But I had to stay home because the baby was sick. On Tuesday, Laurie said suddenly, "Our teacher had a friend come to see her in school today." "Charles' mother?" my husband and I asked at the same time. "Nah," he said. "It was a man who made us do exercises. We had to touch our toes like this." Laurie showed us how. Charles did not do the exercises. "Didn't Charles want to do the exercises?" I said. "Nah," Laurie said. "Charles was so bad to the teacher's friend that he would not let Charles do the exercises." "Bad again," I said. "He kicked the teacher's friend," Laurie said. "The teacher's friend told Charles to touch his toes like I just did, and Charles kicked him." "What are they going to do about Charles, do you suppose?" Laurie's father asked him. Laurie could not say. "Throw him out of school, I guess," he answered. Nothing special happened on Wednesday and Thursday. Charles shouted during story hour, and he hit a boy in the stomach and made him cry. On Friday, Charles stayed after school again. So did all the other children. With the third week of school, the word Charles had become part of our family. The baby was being a Charles when he filled his wagon full of mud and pulled it through the house. Even my husband, when he accidentally pushed an ashtray off the table, said, "Looks like Charles." During the third and fourth weeks, it looked as if Charles had reformed. Laurie reported unhappily that Charles was so good today that the teacher gave him an apple. "What?" I said. And my husband added carefully, "You mean Charles?" "Charles," Laurie said. "He passed out the paints to the other children. Then he collected the books. The teacher said he was her helper." "What happened?" I said. I could not believe it. "He was her helper, that's all," Laurie said. "Can this be true about Charles?" I asked my husband that night. "Can something like this happen?" "Wait and see," my husband said. "When you have a Charles to deal with, this may mean he's only plotting." He seemed to be wrong. For over a week, Charles was the teacher's helper. Each day he passed things out, and he picked things up. No one had to stay after school. The parent-teachers meeting is being held again next week, I told my husband one evening. I am going to find Charles' mother there. Ask her what happened to Charles. I would like to know. I would like to know myself. On Friday of that week, things were back to normal. "You know what Charles did today?" Laurie said in a voice full of excitement and wonder. "He told a little girl to say a bad word, and she said it, and the teacher washed out her mouth with soap." Charles laughed. "What word?" his father asked unwisely. Laurie said, "I'll have to whisper it to you. It's very bad." He got down off his chair and went around to his father. His father bent his head down, and Laurie whispered joyfully, His father's eyes widened. Did Charles tell the little girl to say that? She said it two times, Laurie said. Charles told her to say it two times. Monday morning, Charles said the bad word three or four times. He got his mouth washed out with soap each time. That evening, my husband came to the door with me as I started out for the parent-teachers meeting. "Invite Charles' mother over for a cup of tea after the meeting," he said. "I want to get a look at her." "If only she is there," I said with a prayer. "She'll be there," my husband said. "I do not see how they could hold a parent-teachers meeting without her." At the meeting, I sat looking at all the women's faces. I tried to discover which one hid the secret of Charles. None of them seemed tired enough to be Charles' mother. No one stood up and made excuses for the way her son had been acting. No one talked about Charles. After the meeting, I found Laurie's teacher. "I have wanted to meet you," I said. "I am Laurie's mother." "Oh, we are so interested in Laurie," she said. "We had a little trouble with him the first week or so, but now he's a fine little helper. Most of the time, anyway. Laurie usually learns to obey and to cooperate very quickly," I said. "I suppose this time it was Charles' influence." "Charles?" the teacher asked. "Yes," I said, laughing. "You must have your hands full in that class with Charles." "Charles," she said. "We do not have any Charles in the class."
You have just heard the American story, Charles. It was written by Shirley Jackson. Your narrator was Kay Gallant. The Voice of America invites you to listen again next week at this time for another American story told in special English. This is Susan Clark.